Yes, I just wanted to briefly say that, yeah, I'm open to anything here. We could talk about politics. We could talk about the Objectivist movement. We could talk about philosophy. We can talk about history. We can talk about anything anybody wants. I'm wide open, no holds barred.
All right. Well, Jay.
Well, actually, I don't have a question.
So. You just kept keeping us company.
Yeah, I just came to learn a little bit, get warmed up. I'm sure I'll have one in a little while, but don't right now. Thanks.
Okay. Well, Rob, one question I have is I was just reviewing all of the photos from the gala, which I believe we're posting, if we haven't already posted, to Facebook. And I saw you had a nice long talk with Palmer Luckey. What was that like?
Oh, yeah, that was fun. We talked basically about, so years ago, probably around 2016 or so, the thing I did to keep me sane during the 2016 election is I edited a site for Real Clear Politics. It was one of their sub-sites. You know, they have Real Clear Politics at the main site. You probably hear about them because they have this polling average that they do that's used to sort of to do the election horse race. But they also have sub-sites, Real Clear World and Real Clear Markets, that I've worked for at various times. And I was doing something called Real Clear Future, which is about emerging technology. So, of course, this is right about the time that Palmer Luckey came out with the Oculus Rift, which was the first really functional, really attractive virtual reality headset, and then got bought out by Facebook. And there was also the whole calamity with him being, you know, outed as somebody who had given money to support some pro-Trump ads. And he talked about that at the gala, that, you know, to him it was, you know, having just been bought out by Facebook, having this enormous amount of money, he thought this was just pocket change. And it became, blew up into a big thing. People demanded he be removed from Facebook's board, et cetera. And I wrote about that at the time. So we talked a little bit about that, because I'd written a piece called Soviet Valley, talking about, you know, the culture of political conformity in Silicon Valley. But mostly we talked about about virtual reality and what it would take for it to really take off. And we talked about how, you know, I guess the thing that I talked about was, you know, people talk about how there's not a lot of people own these headsets yet or are using them. But at the same time, you could ask how many people had a personal computer in 1982. Now, this is something I remember and Palmer doesn't, because he wasn't alive at the time. But, you know, there was a very small number of people who had a personal computer in 1982. But it was at the point where you started to get this adoption of, you know, you had a core of people who were using it actively and providing an incentive and a base for people to develop apps and develop new technology and keep iterating and make it better and better and better, to the point where, you know, we all now carry a supercomputer around in our pockets. I'm talking to you right now on my phone, which is, you know, doing stuff I couldn't have done with the most sophisticated computer in 1982. So we talked about how basically he thinks that virtual reality is at that stage where it's got that base of early adopters and of people using it. And at this point, it's just a matter of iteration and getting better and better stuff and more apps. And, you know, it's at the stage where it's now has the base from which to take off. So that was the main thing we talked about, is the tech stuff.
Very cool. Well, as we're having a few other people filtering into the room, I want to, of course, welcome you. We're the Atlas Society Club on Clubhouse, and we're here with our senior fellow, Rob Trusinski. He is also the author of the Trusinski Letter. He's a widely recognized expert on objectivism and writes frequently on politics, foreign policy, and culture. So we're going to record the session and also open it up to any questions you may have. So just raise your hand, and no questions are off limits. Jay.
Yeah. Rob, what do you think the right lessons are from the elections, and what do you think the lessons that the two parties will learn? Because I assume those will be quite different. I've already had some interesting conversations with people that line up on both sides, and it seems to me they're not learning the right lessons, and they're amplifying what I'll call their motivated reasoning view of how to fit a narrative. But your thoughts appreciated here.
Yeah, that motivated reasoning, and in politics, we often call that wish casting, because it's forecasting, but or it's disguised as forecasting, but it's really just you saying the thing that I wish would happen is what's going to happen, but you don't necessarily have the evidence for it. Yeah, I think the parties can generally be counted on to always take the wrong lessons from events, because they have their own internal dynamics that you know they want to appease a certain faction that's powerful that is not. That has that motivated reasoning of wanting to say, oh, well, you should adopt our agenda. And they'll push that no matter what the lesson is. So I wrote about the so when I was at the Atlas Gala, I thought, okay, I'll, you know, don't want that much to do. I at my hotel before I go to the event. And then, of course, we had that election just Tuesday before the gala. And I ended up spending a lot of time in my hotel room before the gala trying to finish an article talking about the Virginia election, because it turned out to be way more important than I expected. And it's not just Virginia, it's elsewhere. I'll talk about that in a second. But the big thing that happened to the Virginia election is it turned into kind of a referendum on the schools and on who has control over the schools, the parents or the bureaucrats. And, you know, Terry McAuliffe stepped into it by basically saying, I don't think parents should have control over what goes on in the school. I think that should be done by the educational bureaucracy. Now, he didn't say it in those words. He kind of stumbled into it. He meant to be saying something slightly different, but once he got there, he couldn't get himself out. It was painful to watch. And the reason is because, the Democratic Party politician cannot come out and oppose the teachers' unions at all on anything. He has to buddy up with them. So he actually brought in Randy Weingarten, the head of one of the teachers' unions. He brought her in to campaign for him, which was the worst mistake he could possibly make. So he doubled down on this idea that basically the educational bureaucracy owns your kids. They get to decide what your kids are taught. And the election, within a period of a couple of weeks, it was, you know, the Democrat was ahead by about 5 points in the polls. And then that gaffe happened. And within a couple of weeks, he went to being, you know, 2 or 3 points behind and losing. And it became a referendum on critical race theory and wokeness in general, and so what we used to call political correctness, in the schools, in the public schools in Virginia. And the lesson I take from the election, now there were other complicating factors like the pandemic and the fact that the public schools were terrible in their response to the pandemic. They basically shut down and abandoned kids for about a year. There's a lot of discussion right now about the learning loss that's coming from that, that Zoom school was not an adequate substitute for in-person school. And parents felt just totally abandoned by the public school systems. So that was part of it. There are other complicating factors. But to the extent that it did become something of a referendum on this sort of political correctness and wokeness. And the lesson I took from the election is, if you give the public a chance to vote against wokeness, they will. Now, that has two parts. One is they will vote against wokeness. They don't like these ideas. And you can look at the polls. These ideas, there's like 8% of the public who are these hardcore progressive Democrats who are really all in on the latest woke or politically correct ideas and pushing all of this. And, you know, the problem is they're all on Twitter and they dominate Twitter. But as a percentage of the public, they're like 8%. So they're tremendously unpopular, even with much of the Democratic Party base. So if you give people a chance to vote against them, they will do that. Now, the problem is you have to give them a chance. That's the second part. That's the lesson for Republicans that I think they should take, is that Trump was not on the ballot in Virginia. And the guy who won, Glenn Youngkin, who won in Virginia, was this very sort of mild-mannered, moderate Republican. 10 years ago, he would have run as a Mitt Romney Republican, probably. A guy who was considered sort of safe and unfrightening for the Northern Virginia suburbs. And also somebody who's really defined himself on his own terms and was not sort of defined as being, this was a vote for Trump, this was a vote for Glenn Youngkin. So because of that, I think it gave people, and he actually outperformed Trump by a good percentage from the last election. So it's clear that he was pulling over. He was basically stealing people away. He was stealing the suburban voters who had moved against Trump in the 2018 and 2020 elections, moved back towards the Republicans in this election because they made it into a referendum on the schools and a referendum on wokeness. So I think that's the lesson to be taken for Republicans is you can do very well by riding these extremely popular issues without this unpopular, fragmenting front man of Trump. I don't think Republicans are going to take that, are going to learn that lesson. The lesson for Democrats is you could do very well if you put the skids under the woke people and appeal to, you know, the moderates and to normal people who aren't blinded by this ideology held by this very small group of people. And I just saw a piece article today that some top Democratic strategists are going to go all in on the critical race theory issue, defending critical race theory, attacking the Republicans on that, as if that's a winning issue. And we just had an election to demonstrate that it's a losing issue. So I think it's pretty clear they're the Democrats, it's going to take them a while at least, if they ever learn this. It's going to take them a while to learn the lesson. And in the meantime, they're just going to make it worse.
Yeah, one follow-up. Do you think there's a window to bring what I'll call the proper ethics of individualism into this conversation that is in any way politically positive? Because, you know, the founders and the language of the Declaration and the application of that to all of these principles would strike me as pretty powerful and upbeat for most thought.
Yeah, well, this has been my sort of campaign that I've been working on for the last year or so, which is the idea of trying to form an alliance of sort of classical liberals on the right and genuine liberals to the extent that such thing exists on the left. You know, these sort of center-left, anti-woke people like Steven Pinker and Ann Applebaum, and there's a whole group of these people. Jonathan Rauch, I've interviewed and talked with.
Alan Dershowitz.
Yeah, okay. So there's a whole bunch of people who'd be considered liberals in the old 20th century sense, and that they are sort of pro-welfare state and kind of pro-big government, but they're not totalitarian, and they don't buy into the woke ideology, and they sort of have a more normal outlook on life. They are liberals in at least some genuine sense of being pro-freedom. Because, you know, the word liberal means – one of my long-standing pet peeves is conservatives who will describe anybody on the left, you know, Bernie Sanders and what have you, as a liberal. And even pollsters will say, oh, extreme liberals, or, you know, they'll categorize as extreme liberals. And they're people who aren't liberal at all, not in any sense. And if you ask sometimes some of them will call themselves progressives, which they don't deserve to do either. But if you ask a lot of the far left people, if you ask them whether they're liberals, they'll say, no, we hate the liberals. You know, neoliberal, referring to the center left, is like the worst epithet that they can come up with. But there's this thing that's stuck in the language that anybody who's on the left is a liberal. But it's not true. There is a faction of the left that is still liberal in the sense that they have a base commitment to the idea that freedom is good. And they might be for big government, but with certain limits. You know, they're not totalitarian about it. Whereas I think that I want to sort of pursue the idea of getting an alliance where we start to work with these people where we can, and also to influence them where we can, and to sort of wean them off to build up their independence from the sort of Marxist influenced far left ideology of the woke left. So I think there's an opportunity there. What I see, though, is that we have to also acknowledge that in the anti-woke coalition on the right, there is a fragmentation, and I'm seeing this start to come up. I'm actually writing something about this in the near future, possibly for – well, I won't say where it's going to be because it hasn't been done yet. But I'm writing something about this fragmented, the anti-woke coalition, that I think there's two types. There are – the sort of classical liberal right, which is against wokeness because it's because it's an assault on freedom of thought. And, you know, somebody Damon, I think somebody who's actually center left wrote something very perceptive about this, about how the problem with the woke ideology and the late, you know, the conformity to the latest terminology and all that sort of thing is not just that some of these ideas are crazy in the content of the ideas, it's that they're subject to change without notice by basically a Twitter mob decides that suddenly the words you can use without being a bad person have changed. And there's no public discussion. There's no process of persuasion. This is, you know, rule by a faction or clique. It's anti-democratic in that sense, in the deepest sense. So, you know, there are those of us on the right who are against wokeism because we're pro-liberty. We want to have a free society. There is also a faction of the right that sort of claims that, oh, we're the most anti-woke people, but they're anti-woke because they want to impose a quote-unquote nationalist solution where they basically say there's one – they just had a conference of these national conservatives, they call themselves. And one of them, Yoram Hazony, said something about how, you know, it included a recognition that in a country like America, that you – a recognition that this is a Christian majority country, and therefore that implies certain rules, that basically we get to enforce this idea of Christianity as being the ruling or dominant ideology of the country or morality of the country. So there are people who aren't against wokeness because it's illiberal. They're against wokeness because it puts the wrong people in charge, and they think a different faction should be in charge. And I think we're going to have to face up to that split and bring that out into the open and, you know, sort of make that differentiation clear in our minds.
Great. Jay, any follow-up?
No, just thanks. But that last one seems to me to have diminishing traction. I know it's very concentrated, but it just doesn't have any ability to grow, especially against the demographic. So maybe some of that crowd will kind of wake up to can't have it my way, but at least we try to go back to these ethical principles that we could all unite around anyway.
Yeah, I think I talked about that a little bit last time, the last Clubhouse, I think it was, where there's sort of a chicken and egg problem. I was talking about magical thinking, and there's sort of the chicken and egg problem that the nationalist conservatives have, the sort of the people who sort of dream of bringing back established religion. I shouldn't even say bringing back because we've never really had it in this country. They dream of having established religion, and the chicken and egg problem they have is that they could get established religion and the government support for religion if they could get enough people who agree with them. But the whole problem is they don't have enough people who agree with them. So they have to get, you know, you could get established religion if you get enough people who agree with you, and you could get enough people who agree with you if you had government support for religion. But it's this, you know, catch 22 where you can't really get started on the process. So I think it is futile, but it's like wokeness on the left, that, like I said, this, you know, wokeness is like 8% of the population, but they're the loudest, angriest, most active faction within the Democratic Party. So it's hard for the party to go against them. And I think the national conservatives and the religious conservatives are sort of like that within the Republican Party, that it's not necessarily the majority of the party. It's not necessarily – they're not necessarily going to be able to win and get their agenda. But what they can do is kind of dominate the spaces where conservatives gather and the spaces where the conservatives talk to each other and have this disproportionate impact on the party because they're the loudest, you know, most fanatical people. And that's the problem every political party faces. How do you keep your fanatics from taking over the thing and making you unpopular?
Thanks. I want to recognize a couple of people in the room, including Professor Richard Salzman. He is a senior scholar at the Atlas Society. And I see Nina, a friend and a supporter. And yay. Come on up, Richard. All right. As he's making his way up, Scott, did you have a question or a comment? And sure. Again, inviting the audience to go ahead and raise your hand if you'd like to ask a question of Rob Trusinski.
Yes, thanks, Jennifer. Great show. Also, looking forward to Peter Thiel's speech being updated, if that's going to happen. Rob, just real quick, you know, I just see... I was pro Trump. I'm anti woke. I don't know which category you'd put me in. I'm not religious. I grew up Jewish, so I'm not looking for a theocracy. But I just, you know, I just want to know what it's going to take to kind of bring you back in a way to, you know, just not be, you know, at odds with the Christopher Rufos or the James Lindsays, and where we're all just directing our firepower at the wokeness.
Well, Christopher Rufo, good you mentioned him. I regard him, I think now he's somewhat circumspect about this, but I have strong suspicions that he is part of this nationalist kind of crowd, that his big I want to say he's done. So I want to talk about the idea of the two versions of anti-woke. There's, you know, there are these two different factions of anti-wokeness on the right, that they're the classical liberals versus the nationalists. And I want to say it's not my contention that we could never work with them or benefit from what they do. I think Chris Rufo has done some great – basically what he's done is he's gone out and leaked all these documents that people send him of, you know, these documents where you have people saying, oh, yes, we're going to introduce critical race theory, or we're going to introduce this latest, you know, woke insanity into the schools in such and such a district. And he basically subjects that to the light of day. And that's a hugely positive thing. However, I'm pretty strongly convinced he is part of the nationalist faction that wants to say, you know, the solution here isn't that everybody should be free. The solution is that we should be imposing our own agenda on people. And so the thing is, you could work with somebody like that and benefit from what he does, but you have to keep in mind that you and he have different goals. And, you know, it's so the idea is I don't want to, okay, this is going to sound over the top, so I'm going to just acknowledge that I don't mean this in a more literal direct way, but it's a little bit like, you know, America allying with the Soviet Union against the Nazis, right? So there's two ways to do it. One way is you can say, oh, great, these are our friends. They share our values. I mean, I think Ayn Rand testified at the House Un-American Activities Committee about how the Roosevelt administration basically sent instructions out to this propaganda apparatus to tell Hollywood to make movies that would make the Soviet Union look good. So that we, you know, because they're our allies, we have to make them look good. She said, well, you don't have to do that. You can say, all right, you know, it's in our interest to work with them for now, but let's be honest and open about what their ultimate goal is, and that it's, you know, that it's opposite of ours. I think that the anti-woke people like Chris Rufo, I view that as, at most, it's an alliance of convenience. At its best, it's an alliance of convenience. But you don't take your eye off the ball and ignore the fact that a lot of these guys, and I'm going to get the goods on Chris Rufo. I haven't gotten this all laid out, but at some point I'm going to write about this. Where I'm not sure exactly where he falls, but I know there are a lot of people in that camp whose attitude is, what we need to contract wokeism is we need to take over the schools and then pass laws telling the schools what they can and cannot teach and making sure it's the stuff that we like. And that's sort of the anti-liberal answer to wokeness. And that's what I'm against. And I think you just need to be clear in your own mind about, you know, who stands, you know, about the fact that we do have different goals there. Now, as to getting me back to Trump, It's not about me getting back anywhere. I didn't change. I'm going to steal a line from Reagan. I didn't leave the party. The party left me. So I sort of feel with Trump, I sort of feel like I'm the same. Everybody else changed. So I'm just going to put that out there. But I don't want to talk the whole about Trump the whole time.
Yeah, I don't even want him to be the candidate in 2024. I'm just saying the idea of having a fighter that, you know, may even come off as somewhat populist is probably not going away anytime soon. I mean, some of what the people that are fighting against it, they're trying to preserve, like the Bush-Cheney political dynasty, more than they care about, you know, principles.
Well, you know, this is politics, and you're probably not far off in assuming that practically nobody involved in it at the end of the day cares about principles. So I'm not going to argue too much about that. And yeah, every political party is a coalition of factions, and they're always angry with each other because no one faction gets what it wants. But from that perspective, the thing that I look at from the Trump era, and I'm not even going to talk about Trump, I'm just going to say from the Trump era, that is troubling to me, is that it has been a bad time for the pro-free market classical liberal faction, which used to have, you know, a very important role in the conservative movement or the right in general, and in the Republican, have an influence on the Republican Party. Now, not enough, because we always complained that we never got really what we wanted, but it used to at least be this sort of accepted, accepted as one of the major factions that had to be appeased in some way. And the big thing change I've seen is the rise of this sort of nationalist slash religious faction has been tremendously empowered in the last 5 years. And that's what I see as the troubling sort of aspect of what you call Trumpism, is that, and I think it comes from the idea that that freedom, you know, what we would call liberalism in the proper sense, or the pro-freedom agenda of the sort of the Reagan years, has been that the conservative movement has redefined itself around nationalism, which has, and in some cases, in the case of some of these people, very explicitly, has a very collectivist sort of connotation to it, right? So it's that, you know, the good of the nation is the ultimate standard for politics and not the freedom of the individual. And so that the rise of that nationalist faction is the big thing I see from the last 5 years that I see as the thing to worry about.
Richard.
Yes, thank you. Thanks, Jack. Thank you, Robert. I don't agree that the last 5 years has seen an ascendancy of the religious right. I think the way the evangelicals just fell head over heels for Trump was just ridiculous. It was just totally ridiculous, because he had been pro-choice for years and just flip-flopped. They knew that.
And also, so Richard, I was going to say that we also have to appreciate, they being here in Virginia, not too far from Lynchburg, I appreciate the way that Jerry Falwell's university has been revealed as a den of sin and iniquity.
Yeah, I
mean, Jerry Falwell Jr., all the scandals there. Yeah.
Not sure I ever also, in a Q&A during one of the primaries, during the primaries, Trump was asked whether he would jail doctors who performed abortions. Answer, yes. I mean, I don't even think, no one ever came close to doing that. And I was just waiting for them to ask whether the would-be mother would be jailed, since they were both in on the murder, unquote. Now, my question is, I think the problem is he's appealing to, and I agree with you, nationalism, but also populism. So these are two isms that are totally anti-capitalist. So he's part Hoover, protectionist businessman. But then he's also part this Weimar mix, where he's giving nationalism and AOC and others are giving socialism. And as Leonard Peikoff showed in Weimar Germany, the two got together eventually and said, how about national socialism? So we're definitely moving toward fascism in that regard. My question deeper, Rob, is I know you are interested in this. I'm interested in this. For years, I have tried to, behind the scenes, talk to the Republican Party, mostly on issues and positioning and strategy. And what would you advise the Republican Party? Because I am a true blue Republican, and I think from the time of Lincoln onward, there's so much to be proud of, and the Democrats should just be absolutely ashamed of themselves. But nobody knows the history. But if you were just advising them, you know, you're standing in front of the upper ups of the Republican Party of America, what would you advise them?
Oh, boy. I think it's the same thing I'd advise them to do for all these years, which is grow a spine. But I think, you know, not having a spine, you know, in the old days, by the old days, I mean, you know, before 5 years ago, which doesn't seem that long ago, but things changed. But, you know, sort of in the Tea Party movement era, I would say, you know, actually go stand up against big government. Actually, you know, repeal Obamacare. I mean, the most disappointing thing about 2017 is you had a Republican president, you had Republicans with a majority in both houses of Congress, and they couldn't, you know, they've been promising us for 6 years that they were going to repeal Obamacare, and then they just couldn't. They came up with something they called a repeal that didn't really do very much, and then when people realized it didn't do much, nobody wanted to vote for it, and the whole thing died. So the thing is, there are, let me put it this way. We talked about populism, and this is something I'm going to take a little time on this because this is something I feel strongly about, which is that there is almost like a good version of populism in the sense that free markets and classical liberalism have a whole bunch of things that would actually be popular, a whole bunch of aspects of that of our ideology that would actually be popular with the average person if we actually championed them. And so I go back in history. So we're talking about the history of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has some good aspects of the history. You just have to go way back. So I wrote a piece a number of years back called Radical New York City Democrats. And if you think Radical New York City Democrats, what are you thinking, right? You're probably thinking, okay, people who read The Jacobin, which is this, you know, communist, basically communist magazine in New York City. You know, today a Radical New York City Democrat would be a communist. Well, in 1835, the Radical New York City Democrats were a group called the Locofocos. And this was a sort of the laissez-faire wing of the Jacksonian Democratic Party. And their whole campaign was – you probably know about these guys because their whole – Richard, because their whole campaign was to separate banking.
Free banking, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was to separate the government from banking and money.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think they sort of – the movement kind of faded because they got what they wanted. They actually achieved their main goal.
Yeah.
And they sort of drifted off and became like free soil Republicans, and a bunch of them became anti-slavery people afterwards. But this was – the interesting thing about the Locofocos to me is there's a whole colorful story about how they got the name, the nickname the Locofocos. They were named after a brand of match because they tried to take over a meeting of the Democratic Party in New York City, which was controlled by this corrupt Tammany Hall faction. And they tried to take over the meeting, and the establishment faction tried to stop them by turning off the gas lights in the meeting hall. So they took their Locofoco matches, which is this newfangled friction match, and used them to light candles and continue the meeting. So they were called the Locofocos. This is a very colorful story. But they were a populist party in a certain sense of that word, that they were described as a coalition of working men and reformers. And the whole essence of their agenda was the idea that government interference in the economy always creates a protected class. It always benefits some entrenched interests. And we want – they're actually – the official name – the nickname was the Locofocos. Their official name was the Equal Rights Party. And it was the idea that, you know, we stand for equal rights, that everybody has the same rights. And whenever government gets involved, it gives new rights to the people it's protecting and supporting and takes rights away from somebody else, which is a great argument to make, a great sort of ideological perspective. So there is, you know, there's this whole constellation of issues we could be working on that would be popular, that would appeal to the common man, that would you know, not just – I think what happened is that by the sort of Bush era, that to some extent the free market wing came to be shrunk down to mean cuts in marginal tax rates because that's what our big money donors want. And the rest of the free market agenda got kind of lost and didn't have momentum. It was about appeasing the donor class by cutting the marginal tax rate, which is great. I'm all in favor of cutting the marginal tax rate, but that can't be what defines your agenda when you're trying to go out and get, you know, 100 million, 120 million people to vote for you. So I think they sort of lost a sight of what the real ideology of pro-capitalism actually implies and the extent to which it is a doctrine for the common man. It's a doctrine that should be able to appeal to everyone. I guess that's the biggest big picture thing I would say is that the falseness of the sort of nationalist populism, which really is about creating, you know, protected classes and getting government to go in and help steelmakers, but then screw over everybody else. And so the sort of the, tell them to ignore the false populism and go find that there's tremendously appealing agenda in being in favor of free speech, against wokeness, and in favor of getting rid of all these barriers that get in people's way to becoming successful and happy and wealthier, that they should be crusading against. But, you know, they have sort of lost sight of that agenda. I think The wider thing, though, is that I don't think that going to talk to the top members of the Republican Party is going to make a difference, because they're politicians. They go where they see people, where they see the, where they go where they feel that the factions are pushing them. I think what we've discovered is that there's been an ideological neglect of the foundations of liberalism in a free society. Not just in economics and not just in politics, but a neglect of it philosophically. I can think of this whole group of sort of lions that we think of as the great champions of freedom, like the Thomas Sowell types, who were all highly active 30 years ago. I can't think of a lot of people who I would name as their successors today. So I think that we sort of neglected the philosophical and intellectual foundations of a free society and of free markets. And that needs to be revitalized. And nothing, the direction of the Republican Party, the direction of politics, is going to depend on us doing some of that work to revitalize it. And I think, though, that, you know, like the Virginia election shows, there's a constituency that will vote for that. Just one small thing to add to that. For example, one of the things we used to sort of think of as a quixotic crusade back in the 30 years ago was school choice. The idea that, you know, you should have a choice of what to be able to send your kid to a private school instead of being forced into the public school system. Well, that's now become a very mainstream thing, and I think it's been propelled by this anti-wokeness crusade to basically say you should be able to choose what kind of education your kid's going to get by choosing where to send him, where to send your kids. And that actually has taken off, and there's been a whole bunch of states that have actually passed school choice laws. They're promising to do it in Virginia. I'll believe it when they've promised me many things in Virginia and not delivered, so I'll believe it when it happens. But it's definitely become from this very niche sort of crazy libertarian pie in the sky idea to becoming much more mainstream. So I think that gives us the hope of this is a popular thing if we can find ways to champion it.
Yeah, I would just add quickly that populism, you know, that populism isn't just what's popular. It has this very anti-intellectual view. The experts aren't to be trusted. Now, when experts mess up like they have, that's understandable. Or the anti-finance, you know, the farmers, the only one who creates wealth, all that stuff with pop. So I think the deeper problem we have here is people venerate democracy. Vox populi has replaced Vox Dei. You know, the voice of God now is the voice of the majority. And majority rule is just not what's necessarily true. And when you couple that with government schools that lobotomize children, it's just zombies voting for statism. So now I think it is worth trying the senior levels of the Republican Party, because they either give support or not to candidates. And I think what's going to happen with Trumpism is he's going to come and go. He might not. He, even if he wins in 2024, runs, this is an ephemeral thing, and it's we're moving toward personality politics. You know, Obama is venerated, and then Trump is venerated, and they're both, you know, uninformed, narcissistic authoritarians, and that's what we're electing now, in a quote unquote democracy. It's just the ancients and the founders were right. Democracy sucks. It really does suck.
My concern is we're going to get, you know, people are saying, well, what if we could have somebody who has the same policies as Trump, but who'd be smarter about it? Huh. And I'm afraid that's going to lead us to somebody like Josh Hawley from Missouri.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You'll appreciate this, Richard. I've been joking that he needs
the trust busting anti-tech Hawley. Yeah, he's off.
Well, his biggest thing now is we're going to have the Commerce Department is going to be certifying whether you have enough domestic content in your product.
I saw that.
I've been joking that Hawley needs to find a guy named Smoot to help co-sponsor his bills.
I was going to say a law clerk. Wasn't he a law clerk for Roberts? So Hawley's at his end. Thanks, Rob. That was great. Thank you so much. Thanks, Rob.
So I also want to recognize that we have Professor Stephen Hicks in the room. Want to encourage you, the rest of you, to raise your hand, ask the question. Go ahead, Rob.
Can I do a quick plug, since Steven's here, that he and I are going to be doing something tomorrow evening, talking about events, politics and current affair events, But one of the things we're going to be talking about that I'm particularly excited about, and I'm working an article on this right now, is last Thursday, there was a columnist for the Washington Post that published an article about how wokeness and critical race theory and all this racial politics we have right now, its ultimate roots is Immanuel Kant. And I thought, well, if that isn't a fat, slow pitch right up the middle for objectivists, I don't know what is. So Stephen and I are going to be talking about that. It's for me, it's fun because, you know, it's usually like pulling teeth. And when you write about politics, it's like pulling teeth to get people to say, no, really, the ideas of this philosopher are important. You hear me out while I talk about how what Aristotle has to do with monetary theory. and there's an actual connection, but you have to really work to get people to sit still for it even. So when you have this opportunity where suddenly you have a bunch of people on Twitter who, you know, of course, this is Twitter. So all the people who have their degrees in law and epidemiology on Twitter have suddenly read the Critique of Pure Reason in the last week. So you people pronouncing on it. But it's kind of exciting to me to have the opportunity to bring out some of these really profound philosophical issues in response to current events.
Rob, okay to another question, Jag?
Yes, sure. Of course.
The pushback against woke seems to be largely from, you know, sort of people accused of white privilege and whatnot. What has been the pushback against woke from the claimed oppressed as people who are being robbed of agency and aspirations? And same thing with transgender, with the goofiness of acting like there's no difference and in that whole language. And I'll give you one point. KIPP, the charter school, dropped their motto of work hard and be nice because they said it created the false impression that you could achieve in a merit society, that it was up to you. They haven't come up with a new motto yet. Maybe it'll be sit on your ass and be a prick. Maybe that'll be what they come up with.
So that's one of the most promising things about it, actually, is about the resistance to wokeness, is some of it's coming from the rank and file of, you know, Black and Hispanic parents who are looking at this and saying, there was a couple of interviews I saw, exit poll interviews, you know, people coming out of the voting booth and the reporter interviewing them saying why they voted the way they did. And there were Black and Hispanic parents saying, I don't want this stuff in the school for the sake of my kids, because it basically teaches them to not work. It teaches them to regard themselves as separate from everybody else. It's a really poisonous ideology. I've also been in contact with, it's a nice, interesting new organization. They've got a Substack called Free Black Thought, which is basically, they're talking about how there's this tremendous diversity of ideas among Black people, and the idea how condescending it is to claim that they all somehow must inherently back this extremely narrow partisan ideology. And I think that movement is just beginning to build. And I remember I was interviewing one of those guys, Eric Smith, who's very eloquent about it, and he's sort of the front, the leader of this Free Black Thought group, and he's very I really like what he has to say. And he was talking about, we talked about how, you know, 30 years ago, if you want to talk about Black conservatives, there was like, well, there's Shelby Steele and there's Thomas Sowell and the sort of crickets chirp, and how many of them were there? Well, there's dozens of them out there now, and they're just really starting to come up and make their voices heard. So I think that the worst thing that's going to happen to wokeness, and the thing that will ultimately doom wokeness, is when you have, first of all, you're going to have Asians rebelling against it because because they're the ones who do work hard and be nice and are tremendously successful in the American system. And then the result of this is that it's much harder for them to get into elite schools because they're the ones who suffer, you know, despite being quote unquote people of color, they're basically subordinated to other minorities because they actually do work hard and be nice and are too successful. You know, the worst you can be is successful in this system, in this woke system. So they're going to rebel against it, and the Hispanics are going to rebel against it, and a lot of black parents are much more conservative than, you know, the white upper middle class college educated woke people. So I think that you're going to have a rebellion. It's going to become untenable for them, to a large extent, to claim to speak on behalf of all minorities because they don't. And that's going to become, I think, more and more obvious over time.
So I want to again encourage anyone in the audience to raise your hand, ask a question. Also going to prime the pump a little bit with some of the questions that get submitted to us every week from our almost 60,000 followers on Instagram, in addition to Rob mentioned the current events that he's going to be doing with Stephen tomorrow. I wanted to mention that we have Richard, who is going to be doing our clubhouse on Thursday. And I believe Professor Jason Hill is doing our Instagram takeover this week. So one of the questions, and we get like way, way more questions than we can ever answer, and we're trying to answer them in a just a crisp 1 minute video answer, and it can be difficult. But one question that came up either for you, Rob, or maybe Richard, was, is the board game Monopoly a fair analogy for capitalism?
Well, okay, I'll take that on because I've got young kids. They're not so young anymore. They're getting to be teenagers, but I have fairly recently played a game of Monopoly. Let's put it that way. No, it's not a fair and accurate. It's a board game. Board games are by their nature oversimplified, so it is not an analogy for. It's not even monopolistic so much, but it's not an analogy for capitalism because it. Really is about this very much. There's a limited number of assets, and your owning this means you take away the biggest thing that I would say is non-capitalist about the board game Monopoly is everything you build results in something being taken away from somebody else, which is the exact opposite of how the economics of capitalism works, which is everything you build is more wealth and more value that you're pumping out into the economy that benefits everybody else. So it's very much a zero-sum game. Now, the way we played it, though, was we put a modern twist on it because, you know, this is a number of years ago when the kids were younger. And, you know, of course, when they start losing the game, they get really upset. So what we did is we did a series of mergers so that when somebody started to really lose, it was clear that you're just not going to make it. We would do a merger and they would be merged into a larger conglomerate until we had these two massive conglomerates going against each other. And then we all merged into, and we called it Alphabet or something like that. But, you know, it's just a board game. It's by its nature, it's this vast oversimplification of reality. So it's not going to be. And I think at the time it was sort of intended. It had certain anti-capitalist ideas behind it. I don't know too much about the history. But, yeah, it is not a representation of capitalism.
Now, I have a different take. Is that okay, Jay?
That's fine.
I think there's someone... Some of what you're saying is true, but I think it's very capitalist. It might interest people. It was invented actually by a woman, Elizabeth Magee, and she, Rob, you'll love this. She was a Georgist. Henry George. So Henry George had this view, kind of Marxist, but he was a total capitalist in everything other than he said there should be a single tax on real estate because. When you buy a piece of land and then sit back and do nothing and other people build up a city around you, the value goes up and you didn't earn it. So it's Marxist, but also George is a very weird figure because on everything else he said laissez-faire. Okay, so she was a Georgist and she invented it in the early 1900s, the board game, I mean. And it was patented at some point. The reason, just quickly, I think the reason it's more pro-capitalist, it does have this kind of zero-sum game view, but it's really a board game about real estate, not,
you know, stock markets or anything like that. So everybody knows that, right? The reason I think it's pro-capitalist is it's not just roll of the die, random, and then zero-sum game. There is a lot of strategy involved with buying and selling and investing, and should I get a hotel or should I do home? And, you know, what corner will retrieve the maximum revenue? So I'll stop there, but I just wanted to register a... Rob, you and I have to do a Monopoly webinar. I think it'll be fascinating. No, I mean, it might be fascinating because it's just such a...
The Georgism connection makes sense because the whole idea of Georgism is ownership of real estate gives you all power over everything.
Right, right. And also the idea that you land on Park Place because you rolled for it. Yeah. She would say, yes, that's the whole point. You bought this piece of property. You didn't know, you know, would end up being Manhattan. You paid $22 and then it became Manhattan. Anyway, I'll retire for that. I'll stop there. Great question, by the way. Great question.
Yeah, I thought it was cute. Okay, this is a question that comes up every week. I'm not sure if we can lure Professor Hicks up to address it. And that is thoughts on metamodernism versus postmodernism. And if you don't have thoughts, don't feel bad, because every week it comes up and every week I pass on it.
So do I. I skip it every time. I have no idea. Them.
All right. Well, Stephen, we've got the expert on postmodernism. So maybe Professor Hicks, thank you. You can shed some.
Yeah, I don't want to say a whole lot about this. I've had two long conversations on Facebook with advocates of metamodernism, and both times I came away not having any idea what metamodernism is. So I don't think it's anything significant, except it does seem to be people who are attracted to some elements of modernism, some elements of postmodernism, and they see it as this is too cheap, but as a catchy phrase to say we're staking out some compromise territory. Now, beyond that, my sense is that there are some people who are genuine, that they're sort of skeptical. They think modernism makes too strong claims about the powers of reason and so on. But at the same time, they think postmodernism goes too far. But I don't see any principled alternative to either modernism or postmodernism there. I think that's all I'll say about it right now, but that would be a good ask me anything question for a future clubhouse.
Yeah, so I'd say meta-modernism is modernism expressed on Facebook, right? Because their parent company now is Meta.
Uh-huh, I see what you did there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, don't feel the need to laugh at that. That's
yeah.
Well, thank you, Stephen, and I'd love to do that. Because at the very least, this person who keeps asking on Instagram gets questions, it gets kudos for persistence, because every single week, and he's tried it a couple of different ways, including, and maybe there's a better answer to this, he asks whether there are other counters to postmodernism aside from objectivism. Mm.
Well, so, I just want to pop in and say that might be a great thing if you want to hear about that, to tune in to what Steve and I are going to talk about tomorrow night. And we don't have we have probably more time than we have left here to talk about it tomorrow, but I think that ties in really to this question about, you know, Kant as the root of postmodernism and of the root of critical race theory and wokeism. I think we're going to be getting into a lot of that, of what is the ultimate philosophical root of all this, and what do you really need to answer it at that root?
Excellent. Well, yes, we are coming up at the top of the hour. One thing that's dominating the news, I don't know if any of our scholars have views or thoughts that we can fit into 3 or 4 minutes, is the Kyle Rittenhouse trial.
Oh, yeah, I want to say something about that. So I don't want to get too much, because this is going to be explode in the next couple of weeks. I mean, it might literally explode in the sense of people setting things on fire in Kenosha. But this is another. So I've written about this a number of times in the past of different cases like this, and it's a persistent problem that people take one of these cases. The cases of the use of force are very complicated. You have to really get into the facts. There's this whole specific body of law involving what is self-defense and what's legitimate self-defense. And what typically happens in these cases is the average observer has no knowledge of any of that, doesn't bother to gain any knowledge of any of that. And they make a judgment on this case based on a few snippets they saw on the news and their partisan preferences. And I've seen this go both cases. There was a case in California where a young woman was shot and killed by a stray bullet, and it turns out the guy who fired the gun was an illegal immigrant. And so a bunch of people on the right went nuts about how is it this guy's not being convicted of murder. And if you followed the case, there were specific facts that showed that this was this conviction of murder, of first-degree murder, wasn't going to happen. It was just not backed by the – they didn't have the case to prove it. And so people – so my big thing is that individual cases in a court of law are exactly that. They're individual cases. They are not symbols. They're not abstractions. They're not a symbol of some wider social phenomenon. So you have to look at the individual facts, and you have to follow the case. And what's going on here, I think, is what's happened. I don't want to get too much into the details, because that matters less than the method of thinking about it. But in this case, what's happened is that I think the case against Rittenhouse has kind of collapsed. I think you could make a case that it wasn't wise or prudent for him to put himself out there as a sort of vigilante defender of property without proper training or support or being part of a team or anything like that. So he put himself in a position where he was very vulnerable, but it is the case against him has really fallen apart because the guys he shot actually were rioters. They actually were violent. They actually were attacking him, and he was acting in self-defense. So I think he's going to get acquitted, and then there's going to be riots, and people are going to be very angry. But it's because they are following this method of putting their partisan preferences and their overall symbolic investment that they've made, putting that they put the ideas above the facts, and that's the reason why people are going to get angry about it.
Richard, you want to weigh in?
Yes, my own quick take on this is it begins with anarchy, which objectivism opposes. So I'm looking at this kid as a very kind of patriotic law and order kid. The media hates him for that. And he goes to Kenosha because the place is in anarchy. Now it shifts to self-defense, which is an objectivist principle. So to me, it's a very mixed case because on the one hand, there should not be anarchy in Kenosha. There was. It wasn't Kyle Rittenhouse's fault. But the, as Rob put it, vigilantism, this is a reminder to the libertarians out there. You don't want anarchy. You don't want getting rid of the cops and all that bullshit. You want law and order and citizens who actually love the country. I mean, I felt the same way Kyle Rittenhouse did. I wanted to go to Kenosha and say, stop it, and I have a gun. And I hope he's acquitted. I'm not sure he will be. But it's interesting to me as a mixed case of anarchy is terrible and self-defense is proper. So I'll just stop there.
And you are stopping at the perfect time because it is 1:59, at least out here on the West Coast. So I'm going to wrap it up and end the room. Price, I saw you just raised your hand. We're not going to be able to get to your question or comment today, but join Rob Trzynski and Stephen Hicks and myself tomorrow for our webinar. That is at 2 p.m. West Coast time, 5 p.m. East Coast time. And this is a busy week here at the Atlas Society, especially for Professor Hicks, because he's going to be joining in our current events discussion tomorrow. And then right after that, he is going to be teaching the third in his series of courses on capitalism in Atlas Intellectuals. Next week, we have a clubhouse conversation with Richard Salzman. We have another course on capitalism by Stephen Hicks. So just go check out the Atlas Society page, our website. You can check out the events section to keep apprised of everything that we've got going on and follow us on our various platforms. So thank you, everyone, and I will see you back here on Clubhouse Thursday and see you, Rob and Stephen, tomorrow.